number 25-2118, U.S. versus Walker. Ms. Amariello, take a moment and then proceed whenever you're ready.
Hey, please, the court, good morning. My name is Jean Amarillo, and I represent the appellant, Davon Walker. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. This case involves a warrantless entry into the home by troopers. There was no search warrant. The district court correctly found that the officer's subjective belief was unreasonable and that the entry was not made in good faith based to the established
case. You say there was no search warrant.
Correct.
Okay.
The hit and hold, I submit, and I argued in the district court, and I checked my argument just to make sure it was on page 124 of the notes of testimony.
Right.
I argued it was not a search warrant. It was a hit and hold with an order, just an order, a tracking order. So my argument to this court is because there was no search warrant in this case, that hit and hold with the anticipatory warrant for apartment number 2 did not apply in this case because this was apartment 1.
So what you're saying is there was a warrant, but it didn't apply to the correct apartment.
There was an anticipatory search warrant with a hit and hold that applied to apartment 2,
which
correct.
Is a little different saying there's no warrant.
Right. Well, there's no search warrant for apartment number 1. There
right.
wasn't. Yeah.
Granted. We're going to have a discussion about how to construe this and everything. But
yes. Thank you. So I actually obviously handled the motion to suppress. And the testimony that day was that the package was dropped off with a control drop-off at 3:36 p.m. Appellant Davon Walker comes out at approximately 4:15 p.m., retrieves the package that's on the porch, the common porch area, brings it into apartment number 1. Between 4:15 and 9:30, when the officers executed this hit and hold that they claimed gave them authority to go in, nothing happens to that package. They have a tracker and a beeper in there that if the package was moved or the package was opened, that would have given them authority to go in and do the hit and hold.
Okay. Can we deal with a couple of preliminaries? First of all,
yes.
Can we treat the tracker application as, for all intents and purposes, warrant, at least as to apartment 2?
I wouldn't say that it was a warrant. It was an anticipatory search warrant.
Apartment two. Your objection is you wouldn't be making this argument if we were in apartment 2. The issue is, well, different apartment.
Well, I believe that's part of the issue, yes.
Okay.
I don't know if I would be making the argument because the package wasn't opened or moved.
Okay. So it's not an argument it isn't a warrant. It's that it's the wrong place and the wrong warrant.
Well, the anticipatory warrant was for apartment 2, the wrong place. Yes, that is the...
I'm sorry, can I get you to more precisely answer this, though? Because I feel like your answer keeps changing. So for constitutional purposes, do you do or do not believe there was a warrant for apartment 2?
There was an anticipatory search warrant, yes.
Why do you say an anticipatory search warrant? It's like a warrant that's constitutionally valid or not?
For apartment 2,
okay.
If the package would have been taken in there, yes, absolutely.
Okay, fine. And the other housekeeping issue, based on the way I read the record in your brief, you're challenging only Monsa's culpability. You're not arguing that any other officers were negligent or reckless or intentional misconduct, right?
Well, I was arguing as a whole. The reason that we focused on Trooper Montz is because Trooper Montz was the affiant for the subsequent search warrant later.
Okay, but Montz is the focus here of whose conduct was such that the good faith exception wouldn't apply.
Correct.
All right, fine. Go on, please.
So what happens is, rather than waiting, like they should have waited, they actually decided just to go in at 9:30, and Trooper Montz's testimony was we were just going to go in because it was coming up to 10 p.m., which was where we would have to go for a nighttime search warrant, so we just decided to go in. Now, if that package would have been opened, I agree, that would have been the triggering event. However, Trooper Montz argues and states on the record that the triggering event that made him go in for the hit and hold was Mr. Walker, the appellant, bringing the package in at 4:15 p.m. That could not have been a triggering event if you waited over 5 hours to go in to do the hit and hold. And in this case, the district court put the burden on the defense. After he found that Trooper Montz, he said that was his subjective belief. He credits his testimony that was subjective. But he said his belief wasn't objectively reasonable because the tracker.
Okay, but we got a question whether the district court was right to reject the good faith exception here. And the government, with some force, points to language in Tracy, right?
Yes.
And, you know, no question, a lawyer should read this in our cases and say, hey, the fact that it's in the supporting affidavit isn't enough. But under Tracy, shouldn't we pay attention to the officers understandably believing that the language about it's incorporated for all purposes means he's counting on them? And the court credited in that footnote that subjectively he actually believed this. We still have to decide it subjectively, but it seems like a reasonable officer could believe what he in fact believed, which is, hey, I said it in the affidavit. The application refers to this warrant, which it says it's incorporating for all purposes. Therefore, that's enough.
I disagree that that would be objective.
Why was the district court right to reject that?
In the tracker order, when the judge gives the tracker order, she specifically gives 10 different things that troopers were allowed to do. Mm-hmm. Entering another apartment was not one of them. In fact, in that affidavit, they had asked permission if they would be able to enter another location where it was taken to, and specifically it states in those 10 things that that wasn't one of the 10 things that they were allowed to do. So just because you put something in an affidavit and ask permission,
the order doesn't rule it out. It rule out apartment one. It just doesn't list apartment one.
Right. It
does. That's different from specifically rejecting it.
Right, but he asked, he didn't know it was going to be in Apartment 1, obviously, when
right.
he was going to do this. But he asked, in his affidavit, he puts to any other locations mm-hmm. that the package
puts that, and the order omits it. That's
right.
Different from saying you can't do it.
Well, I think an objective reading of that is if you're reading the order that if it's not in there with the 10 things that you're permitted to do, then it's not one of the things that you're permitted to do. I mean, it was pretty clear.
Look, a lawyer, expressio unius, fine. Question whether we should expect an officer to apply the expressio unius canon to the order that comes out.
Well, I would also say objectively looking at the facts of this case, if the objective belief of an officer in this case, officer must subjectively believe that is what the district court said, but it has to be an objective belief of a reasonable officer. And I don't think objectively that they could, a trained officer, he had years of experience doing this. And I believe, yes, Your
Honor. I just have a question about the order and its testing. The district court noted in a footnote that it was unclear, but the only testimony in the record I saw was where Mont said he drafted the order. Do you have a position on what the record reflects as far as drafting?
I believe the record said he drafted the application for the order. I think it was unclear with the testimony whether that order, the actual order, was by the judge or by Trooper Mott. I don't believe that the testimony made clear who actually typed it up.
Okay. Well, if I recall, I just want to get your view. He was shown the exhibit and he said, that's the order I drafted. And are you just saying, why do you think that does not reflect that he drafted the order?
Well, if he did draft the order would have had in there what he requested in the affidavit.
Okay.
And that's
you're deducing it, but you're not basing it on
another
explicit statement elsewhere.
No, not your own. No. So in this case, what the judge did after he found that it wasn't reasonable, he said that the burden shifted now back to the defense to prove that it wasn't, that it was systematic or not just a one-time negligence.
Can I press you more on that point? You know, the government's brief at page 20 points out that Tracy was a lot like this case. And so it's citing 597F3rd at 152. Even though the affidavit was not incorporated, the warrant issued by the court made no reference to corporation like this one, no affirmative statement banning, but no reference. We believe that Police Chief Holler, this is a quotation from Tracy, could have reasonably relied on the warrant because a reasonable officer in his position would assume that the warrant incorporated and would be construed with the attached affidavit. And then, you know, they weren't legally sufficient. We conclude that because the warrant doesn't clearly indicate it. An officer could understandably believe he had met the requirements of the Fourth Amendment. So how is your argument that silence equals a bar consistent with Tracy's argument that silence equals at least a good faith basis for a reasonable belief by an officer, not a lawyer, not a judge, someone else?
if I may, I argue, Tracy, in favor of Mr.
I know, but you're using general background statements from Tracy.
Okay.
The government is using specific ones that deal with the silence and incorporation by reference.
And I think Tracy is completely different from this case. Tracy had a warrant for that actual house in Tracy. The search warrant was for that house. In the face of the search warrant, it wasn't as specific as it should have been for what they were looking for. From my recollection, this was child pornography. But I believe...
So you don't think that the... You think the particularity requirements for the places to be searched and the effects to be seized can be cured by that, but not the particularity as to which apartment within the same building?
Well, I think it's different in this case because the officers in Tracy had a warrant for that house that incorporated the affidavit.
Why wouldn't particularity potentially apply to the package? I mean, if they thought there were drugs there and the package is moving, it's not like they just made up the apartment one location. It was keyed to something particular.
Okay, so when it was being delivered to a fictitious name, John Crick, who they couldn't find who the person was, but it was being delivered to apartment two. It left in the porch area. The occupant of apartment one, who was Mr. Walker, waited approximately 35 minutes before he goes out onto the porch, and you see him go out onto the porch. He takes the package, he brings it inside. So that package never moves. It just sits there. So his conduct, and I believe that the troopers wouldn't have been able to get a search warrant just based on that because the package wasn't open. There was no evidence that would have shown that Mr. Walker knew what was in that package at the time he brought it in. He never opened it. He never moved it.
Can I ask, was there probable cause for the police to go in when, you know, even before the hit and hold, to get a warrant to enter Walker's apartment?
Well, to enter his apartment, absolutely not. To try to get a warrant, I don't believe there would have been probable cause. I think that's why they had the order.
They saw Walker get the package. It
right.
wasn't addressed to him.
Right.
They saw him take it inside. They saw someone associated with criminal activity, Ava Garcia, enter the apartment later. Wouldn't that have been probable cause if they'd gone and applied for a warrant?
No, I don't believe it would be. And the reason would be this. That person who entered and exited his apartment did not take the package. The package wasn't...
Well, I'm talking about when he goes in.
Just because someone comes in your house doesn't give them probable cause.
After he has received a package that they previously opened that they know contains drugs.
But he left without it. And I think that that goes against probable cause.
Weren't the police well on the way to getting a warrant to enter his apartment when they did the hit and hold?
No, actually they were not. That goes to inevitable discovery. And I believe from my conversations with the government, they agree. Because when they did the search warrant for apartment one, the police put in paragraph 14, evidence that they saw when they were in there for the hit and hold. They did not apply for this warrant.
So it's true that there is some stuff in there. But if we omitted that, there still would have been probable cause. I mean, when he eventually applied for one later that night, he used the same affidavit he'd used before. He just updated it a little bit.
Right. But the inevitable discovery doctrine would have to show not that they could have gotten a warrant, they would have gotten a warrant. They have to show that they were actually in the process of doing it, and they weren't. Trooper Montz waited until 10 minutes after the hit and hold to leave to go apply for the warrant. It was not in the process.
I'm not sure you have to show that they're... when you look at the case law on inevitable discovery, you know, Alexander has these three factors, and, you know, one of them is, did they have probable cause? Okay, you disagree about this. Second, how much progress the government had made in applying for a warrant. We have this mostly drafted off. They add a little bit later, and then they apply for it. You know, the affidavit's largely drafted, and then we have to look at cost and deterrence. So, you know, those factors, you may disagree about how to balance, but it's not a rigid requirement that they're in the process of submitting the application. The affidavit is mostly done.
Well, part of inevitable discovery also that is the alternative path to the search couldn't be triggered by the unlawful entry. And in this case, I submit to this court that they would not have been able to get a search warrant without going in there and seeing what they saw. He didn't touch the package. Anybody could bring in a package from a mutual apartment for their neighbor, put it down. There was no evidence at this point to show he knew what he even brought in, is my point. So I'm past time, but if Your Honor has a question, yes.
I mean, it just seems like people know that there's illegal substances. There are illegal substances in the package. So the police are just supposed to let it sit and wait and let it be moved potentially and concealed. I mean, I don't like what would they what were they supposed to do?
Don't
the crime was committed here.
Right. Well,
I feel like your suggestions and you're sort of piecing apart each circumstance rather than looking at the totality of the situation and the potential need and exigency of being able to keep the package from being moved further or concealed or even destroyed.
Well, the reason that they put the tracker in the beeper end is because they wanted someone to open or to move the package. So they wouldn't have probable cause to go in because you couldn't show that Mr. Walker knew that there was a crime at the time by taking that. There was no evidence that Mr. Walker knew. Yes, after the fact, we know. But at the time that he took...
It's addressed to Mr. Walker. It's addressed to probably fictitious Tom Crick, different address. I mean, but it's weird for him to be receiving this package that's known to have drugs. It's not addressed to him. I mean, so it doesn't seem like perfectly innocent conduct.
Well, bringing a package in and leaving it there, maybe not perfectly innocent, but it's not enough for probable cause if he leaves the package there and doesn't move it. He never moved it, never opened it, never went to another location. It just sat there. And I submit that that's why the police decided that they were just going to go in on the hit and hold. You can't have a triggering event 5 hours earlier.
Anything else?
Thank you.
Get back on rebuttal. Mr. Zalzmer.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Robert Zalzmer on behalf of the government. I'd like to start off, if I may, with the inevitable discovery question that the Court presented and explain why the government is not or did not rely on appeal on inevitable discovery. The Alexander case certainly says that if the police are in the process of getting a warrant, that it doesn't matter that you have the illegal entry if the search would be valid based on the warrant. Even more broadly than that, oddly, Alexander says that the Court hasn't resolved whether a hit and hold in general is permissible. And yet the Supreme Court has called that. And what Alexander overlooked was the Segura case in the Supreme Court many years ago, I think in 1984, that explicitly approved a hit and hold where officers held an apartment for 19 hours while they were waiting for a search warrant, saying that that was reasonable. The problem that we had in this case, to be very frank with the Court, is that what Segura says very clearly is that inevitable discovery or independent source or whatever you want to call it depends on the fact that the search warrant that's obtained does not rely in any way in that protective entry that took place. The warrant is simply going to happen based on information that the police already had. That is not exactly what happened here, because when the officers did the hit and hold, they did observe additional evidence. They saw a bag sitting next to the targeted package that looked exactly like what they knew was in the targeted package. And they put that in the final warrant for apartment number one. And so that's the reason that we thought, and perhaps Judge Walton thought as well, that it's best to focus on the good faith and the Herring Doctrine.
Okay, so I get you that it's best to focus. So are you saying that you think Segura does not cover and justify the search here?
I believe it's a close question, Your Honor, and I think this plays off of Judge Bibas's question. If we take out from that later warrant what was seen in the apartment, there clearly is still probable cause to support that search warrant. And so I'm not here to argue against myself. This Court may affirm on any ground supported by the record, and I think you could affirm based on Segura. I disagree with my friend Ms. Amarillo's argument about probable cause. She's focused on the fact that when the police go in, they don't know for sure that Devone Walker is the suspect, that he's the bad guy. All they know is that the package is in the apartment. But that's not Fourth Amendment doctrine. They don't have to know that the person is responsible. The Fourth Amendment allows a search where there's probable cause that evidence of a crime is in a location, and obviously there's evidence of a crime in this location.
Just complaining, Casey, that contraband will be found in a location and PC for arrest.
Exactly. Exactly, Your Honor. And so they know that six pounds of methamphetamine are sitting in that apartment. They have probable cause for a search. They would have gotten a warrant without gilding the lily and adding that additional bit of information.
The warrant is about houses and effects in houses. Not knowing the person involved is important because this isn't an arrest warrant or a warrant to search a particular person.
Precisely. If you had an arrest warrant and you needed a warrant to go in to find that person, then of course that...
I mean, I think there are good reasons why the inevitable discovery is a last resort. If it's close to the line, you're not sure the judge would have issued it, et cetera, but I don't know that it sort of forecloses it, but I think your argument is we don't even need to get there. So I thought that Judge Wolfson, very fine judge, I thought the reasoning of the opinion was a little confusing in that he suggests he read that being pairing as creating a negligence doctrine distinct from good faith. And I think there may be some terminological confusion here because good faith itself is misleading. This isn't about your subjective beliefs. It's about whether you were reasonable or not. But reasonableness, negligence are two sides of the same thing. Does the government honestly think we should be reading Herring as creating a doctrine different from Leon and the good faith exception? I've never seen that. I mean, there's a hint in a case or two, but it doesn't look like the best or right reading of Herring.
No, I think that is not a correct reading of Herring, and that's why we respectfully disagree with the district court about good faith. Good faith and Herring, I wouldn't say they're different sides of the same coin. They're really the same coin. And the Supreme Court explains that in Herring, that Herring is just an extension of the discussion in Leon that says that merely negligent conduct of police officers is not sufficient to warrant the deterrent effect of the exclusion rule. I point to this case in Wright that is cited in our briefs, W-R-I-G-H-T, where this court says that Herring, quote, refines and synthesizes the law in this area. Herring is not different from Leon. What is different is that Leon involves a case with a warrant. Herring involves a case with no warrant. In Herring, the police thought there was a warrant, but the database was wrong, and there was really no warrant at all. So the real significance of Herring is in explaining that this fundamental doctrine, that the exclusionary rule only applies to intentional, reckless, grossly negligent conduct, applies across the board. That's the significance of Herring.
The real question is whether or not a well-trained officer reasonably believes that their conduct was legal, whether that means they're depending on warrant or on a warrant check.
Which sounds like a negligence, not a gross negligence test.
It is a negligence test.
Also, I guess my question is, in the other cases, the negligence, for instance, the warrant check, the negligence was not the officer's. And so if the procedure is routinely reliable, that's reasonable for a well-trained officer to rely on it. But I'm wondering about sort of the gray areas where, when I first got this case, it seemed that the asserted negligence was in not reading the warrant, although reading the testimony is clear that the officer did read the order and perhaps drafted it. But I'm interested in, isn't an officer expected, if this were a case where the officer had just never read the warrant, would that be a well-trained officer could reasonably think their conduct was legal?
I think we're mixing up doctrines here a little bit. If I could just say as an aside, I think it's clear from the record that the trooper did not draft the order. It was drafted by the assistant district attorney. It was the assistant district attorney who prepared the order and his own application. And then attach the
affidavit.
As a matter
of custom, that would seem to make sense. But from the record, where are you getting that?
Well, in any event, when Your Honor says that the test is whether a reasonably well-trained officer would know something, that's a case in which there's no negligence. So your basic Leon case is where you have a warrant. The warrant is sufficient because the magistrate got it wrong. The officer presented everything he knows, said, I think I've got probable cause. The magistrate said, yeah, I think you do, and issued the warrant. And it turns out the magistrate was wrong. As a matter of law, there was insufficient probable cause. The Supreme Court in Leon says the officer hasn't made any mistake at all. The officer has relied in good faith on the warrant that was issued by the magistrate. That's part one. Part two is what the officer does make a mistake, which is not your basic warrant situation. If the officer does make mistakes, take Tracy, for example, doesn't see that it's a general warrant, basically. There's no instruction in the warrant as to what to search for. Or I think France was in the case of this court where the officer makes a mistake and doesn't hand the list of things to be seized as he's required to do at the search, and therefore has made a mistake. In those situations, what Tracy and all the other cases tell us is you have an officer who's made a mistake. Now you're past the objective, well-trained officer. And the question under Herring is, what is the nature of that mistake? Because the exclusionary rule is a drastic sanction that the Supreme Court says only applies where it has a deterrent effect. And there's no deterrent effect where you're dealing with one-time negligence. So what do we have here? What we have here is a trooper who basically did everything by the book. He did the search, got the dog, did a warrant, a tracker warrant, got an anticipatory search warrant, waited outside for 6 hours.
I don't know that we need to say that this officer was negligent. I mean, I think your position, Green's position, you've made a reasonable mistake in understanding how the affidavit or attachment fit together with the order. And I think it'd be a different case because, at least in this situation, if you put the two together, there's particularity. There's just not enough particularity in what's supposed to all be in the self-contained order. So
I accept that, Your Honor, and that's why we argue that this case is stronger than Tracy. Tracy, he checks the box, but basically the wrong box, and the warrant itself does not incorporate the affidavit. In this case, the order, if he read the order, as I assume he did, the order from the judge says, quote, that the application is attached and incorporated for all purposes,
right,
which includes what the officer asked.
Which also means that it has the same constraining effect on his discretion. We might not be granting him, you know, the benefit, good faith exception, et cetera, if he tried to turn this into a general warrant or something. He would have had no basis for it. So it depends on what purposes we're talking about. If it's notice to the apartment recipient, maybe dweller, maybe not, but if it's notice to the officers are still subjectively being constrained by what they understand to be incorporated into the order.
Right. We're talking about the hit and hold. That is what's at issue here. That's what's properly framed by the appellant. The hit and hold permit, he does request the permission. He says he did discuss it with the district attorney. We have acknowledged that maybe there was negligence here, but I would agree we are at the bare edge of negligence. This trooper really did a fine job, and I'm even reluctant to say, knowing what law enforcement has to deal with, that there was much of a mistake. To the extent there was, it was no more than mere negligence. There's no way this can be characterized as gross negligence, which is, you know, I think the lack of care that a careless person would exercise, or however it's been defined by this court. And that's why, at the end of the day, the district court made the right decision in applying the Herring doctrine, though we would certainly apply the good faith doctrine as well based on Tracy.
And I know this is not the facts here, but I'm trying to understand how you're conceiving of what you're calling the second step. Would you say a complete failure to read a warrant is negligence? Would you call that gross negligence? What?
Your Honor, I believe we have to look at every individual case. I mean, my experience is that every case is different, and you have different circumstances. If you had, Judge Beavis just suggested a general warrant. If somebody did not read a warrant and went into a location and trashed the place, you know, when in fact the warrant specifically was only for one particular item, then sure, that might be a different case. But that's not what we have here.
It might be a different case because of the negligence or gross negligence.
Could be gross negligence. It just depends on the circumstances. The Supreme Court certainly doesn't make any effort to define all the facts that happen in life and what could meet the standards, but we know the definition of the standard. We know what gross negligence is. We know what recklessness is, you know, which is conscious disregard of a problem. We know what intent conduct is. And we take it case by case, and this case just doesn't match those at all. Okay. Thank you very much, Aaron.
Thank you, Mr. Salzman. Ms. Amarillo, you reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. And just briefly, Your Honors, in this case, it's objectively reasonable, which is the test. And a trooper with this much experience, I believe the district got it right when he says maybe subjectively he believed it, but for him to believe that was unreasonable. And the district court found that there was no good faith, but they impermissibly put that burden on me to show that it wasn't negligent, that it was not a systematic or recurring act. And again, that was the burden shifting, and that was the reason the appellant believed that this denial of the suppression was incorrect. I think the judge, the district judge, hearing everything and under a totality of circumstances made the right decision regarding that the entry was not in good faith because this was, in fact, a warrantless entry into apartment one. So I would ask your honors to reverse and find that burden shouldn't have been placed on me.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank both counsel for their helpful briefing and arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement. We'd ask the parties to work together to prepare a transcript and that the government would pick up the expense of that. And we'd like to greet Ms. Amariello and Mr. Zalzmer, sidebar briefly to thank them. So off the record for a moment.